Succession number 28411, reel number one.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Pell Williams in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 26th of the 7th, 2005, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Pell, can we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
My full name is Eric Francis Essington Williams. I was born in Northam, Western Australia, 23rd of July 1918.
Where did the Pell come from?
Oh, God, that's a long story, or not so long, I suppose. It's, when I was small, my father used to call me little fella, and I couldn't pronounce it, of course, and it was Zickle Pella. And it broke down from that down to Pell, and I'm afraid it's been my... I've been known as Pell Williams for all my life. I regret in some ways. But there you go. These things happen.
Tell us a little bit about your family.
Well, my parents were born in South Australia. Father in Mount Gambier and my mother in Brighton, out of Adelaide, suburb of Adelaide. And the father was keen to go farming. He worked in Adelaide for a stock firm, Elder Smith and Company Limited, for 4 years. Resigned and came over here in 1901 and took up a virgin block out of just east of York. And a bachelor, of course, and went out there with a horse and dray and a bag of flour and a bag of whatever else they used to eat in those days, a mattock. And he cleared the block and he sold up in 1909 and went to 2J, which is 60 miles east of Perth, and bought another farm, a developed farm there. He married my mother in 1912, and in 1916 he sold the farm and went into Northam and started an agency, of which he did very well at buying, selling farms, or not buying, selling farms, selling stock, had quite a lot of agencies, made quite a lot of money during the 20s. By that time he'd acquired four farms, all with share farmers, and of course the Depression hit the place and he was land poor. And anyway, we struggled through the Depression. I had an elder brother, an elder sister, and a younger sister by this time. And by the end of the Depression, I'd gone to a local state school, then came down to Guildford Grammar School, left in 1935, and went into what I used to call the Home for Lost Dogs, Elder Smith and Company Limited. See, there were all the non-academics used to go to a stock firm or a bank in those days. And I was there for till 1940. And I was transferred to an eastern wheat belt town called Killabarron, where Elders had a branch. And of course, war had broken out by then, and all my cobbers in Perth, we'd all decided that we'd all go together, and when the Germans invaded the lowlands, the situation became Denkin, and I got a phone call from my cobber in Perth, a chap by the name of Doug Burgess, and said, well, we're all going to join up, what about it? And I hopped on the next train, whether Elders liked it or not, and came down and enlisted.
Let's talk about growing up during the interwar period, or between World War One and Two. What was it like?
It's growing up for me. Well, it's pretty well related to the finances of my family, as indeed many families, no doubt. But during the 20s, my brother and elder sister were away at boarding school here in Perth, My sister, younger sister, was 8 years younger, so I was more or less a only child there. And in the 20s, I had a pretty good life, you know, no depression, and Dad was doing well. But when the depression came, it was another planet, really. I mean, not much money coming in. Everything was down the hill, of course. It was a good learning time, really, for someone growing up. You certainly learnt the value of money, but I had to do all the damn chores. I had a big place in Northern, a tennis court, and I had to do all the blasted, cut the lawns and cut the edges every Saturday morning, and we had chooks, we had a couple of horses there, and I had to attend to all those, and in between, when the old man wanted to have a game of tennis, I'd have to drop everything after school and go and have a game with him. And we owned a house at Albany, Midland Beach, Albany, and we used to go down there for 6 weeks every summer, which started during the 20s, and that wasn't sold, fortunately. And we went down up as soon as school broke up in December, and we had 6 weeks down there, which was quite a highlight as far as I was concerned, because it was out of the heat. And we'd been going there since 1924 down to Albany. So I loved the place, and I loved the swimming, and I got to know a lot of the other similar people to us. They had holiday cottages and went down every year. And we were there till school went back. Then back to, from Albany, going back to Northern, was like getting out of a refrigerator into a ruddy oven. Hot place, Northern. And, well, there wasn't much.
How did you see your place in the world? Here you are, growing up in Western Australia. How did the average West Australian see himself?
In relation to
the Empire, in relation to England?
Well, my impression, I wasn't that old, mind you. I was, 15 down, I suppose, 14 down, whatever it was. But my only impression of that was that England was the mother country. Everyone used to refer to going home, and you know, we were just an appendage of England as far as I was concerned. I certainly don't think of it now that way, but but then I did. I mean, we had no radio in the early parts, there were no fridges, all thunder boxes down the back, and it was I was born into it, I suppose. I didn't think we were badly off or anything, but England was just the mother country where we all came from. I never thought of much about the eastern states or our relation to, I don't know, I was more interested in cricket and footy, and girls start to look a bit more interesting, you know, but I don't think my mind got that far away from outside the coast of Australia anyway. But that was my impression. England was it. And, you know, none of us, even when growing up after the war, at least even after the war, everyone had to go to England to see the home country. And I've been there eight or nine times now, but the first time I just remember I couldn't believe it, that I was there actually in London and heard all these famous places and well-known places. It was just, I suppose, if you like to scratch below the surface, it's still my beginnings, really.
All right.
It is, really. How
was the First World War seen, and how was Australia's involvement in that conflict seen by an average young bloke like yourself?
Well, I was a Boy Scout in Northern. I used to march every Anzac Day with the local troops and so forth. And my only impression was that how does someone go to war and not get killed? It really never occurred to me, which certainly does now, why would someone living happily and peacefully in Australia go over there and get killed in a foreign place. My views have changed on that now, but my mother had a book, huge red book it was, with every unit and with its colour patch and its history and its commanding officer, and I used to spend hours poring over that. It just fascinated me, not for any bloodthirsty reason, I just enjoyed it. She had three brothers, by the way, one, and I suppose that attracted me a bit. My father was too old to go to World War One, but I really didn't think much of it. It was just a nasty thing that happened a long way away.
Had you had relatives other than immediate family involved?
You're talking about when? World War One? Yeah. Only those three brothers. Wait a minute. My wife's... my mother, three brothers. My father's younger brother went.
Did they ever discuss the war with you?
I don't know. Well, I don't suppose they'd talk about to a young bloke. I mean, most of them, all of them were in eastern states because my parents came from there. None of them lived here, so they wouldn't have had an opportunity to discuss with me anyway, really. But no, not really. I can't tell you much about that because I was...
Did anyone that you knew over here ever talk about the First World War? Give you an idea of...
Well, we had some World War One return blokes re-enlisted with us. And, yeah, I spoke to them about it, but they didn't tell me much because I remember asking a bloke who was British Army, did you ever kill anyone? And he stripped tips off me for asking such... We never talk about it. Well, my guess was that he never bloody would kill anyone because he always wore his bloody ribbons. He wasn't supposed to. But I was a cobber of an old chap, Jimmy Lang, who's 40-odd. Of course, he's old in our eyes. I was only 21. And he went away with the original 16th. Well, no, he wasn't. The second 11th, original 11th. And he was on Gallipoli, and he used to tell us a little bit. So I never ever quizzed. That's about as close as I ever got to chatting about the World War One that I can recall quickly, anyway.
So growing up, during... you mentioned the Depression... the 30s. What was the 30s like for a young bloke in Western Australia?
Well, I think it's an awful thing to say, but I think it's a shame that every young bloke doesn't have a short experience of a depression because you know what society's like now. Gimme, gimme, gimme. Those days, you really had to go and work hard. If you're that age, to get very little. Everyone was hungry, not in the physical sense, but you didn't have money for any luxuries whatsoever. And you had to be careful. I think my father, early on we had a maid and we had a gardener, etc. But all those luxuries disappeared with the Depression, and we lived on £5 a week. It was very bad old days, and of course, that to me, it rolled on almost into the Second World War. But it was the early 30 to 35 were the hard times. Mm. And we were no exception. I mean, everyone's in the same boat.
Mentioning obviously how the Depression was affecting you. Did you know how the Depression was affecting places like England or Europe at all?
No, I've got no recollection of that. No, I haven't. I'm only going to express an opinion now. But I had no... See, we only got a paper, no radio. The paper didn't come till about midday in those days, from Perth, on coming up by train, I suppose, from somewhere. No, I had no... I seem to recollect cues from a bowl of soup. But I think I recollected that in England, I think. Mm. But I'm not sure. Mm. There's no medium those days. Like
so when was it that you first heard of troubles brewing in Germany, for instance?
Well, I remember reading about Hitler and his various coups. But it didn't cut much ice with me. I didn't know, a bit like someone coming out in Afghanistan now. It was just a name but I think probably about 1937-38 I realised there was something not too good going over there, and I suppose when he invaded, where did he invade? Czechoslovakia, was it, or one of those places? We put our heads together and said, well, it was sort of automatic, that if there's a war, you go to it. Like the First World War.
What about Poland?
Oh, that was the immediate start, wasn't it, Poland? Mm. That was the start of the Phoney War, wasn't it, Poland?
Let's add in a few dates that I have here. Obviously, in 1938, we have Chamberlain going over and coming back
that's
with
right.
his
yeah.
newspaper. Do you
yeah, I knew things. I certainly have recollections of things getting serious then.
Yeah.
It was a long way away, and plenty of neon signs and bright lights in Perth. I was having a ball. But we knew from this distance that things weren't too good over there. And then the...
Peace in our time, he's declared.
That's right, with the umbrella. Mm. Yeah, I remember that.
Do people believe that?
They believed that he was sincere, I would think. I certainly did. I never sort of stopped to analyse it, really. But I think Poland was the thing when I thought...
Poland is definitely what started the Phoney War.
38, I knew we all grew up, young blacks together, all knew that there's probably going to be a blue over there. And I took it upon myself, because I want to see the Northwest, of getting leave of absence from Elder Smith to get up the shearing team up north.
So here you are off on a trip up north.
Ah, yes. Mm. That was 1938. And I went away on a shearing team. There's a rouseabout where you've got to pick up the fleeces, chuck them on the table, sweep the floors, and beck and call the shearers. And the wool season, and I was in the wool department, started about September, and they told me I had to be back by the end of September. Anyway, my copper mine, Doug Burgess, met me. I came down by ship from Carnarvon, and it was then that he said that all joined... we all joined the Cameron Highlanders, because it was... Well, he didn't know. He thought he had to do something to be flying the ruddy flag.
Why?
Well, war clouds, I suppose. You could see that things weren't too good over there. It never entered our head that we'd, this place would be threatened, because we'd never heard of the Japs, hardly. But anyway, we joined up, and I was no sooner, we'd all joined Cameron Harland's militia, Scotty Highlanders, and I was transferred to Kellerberrin.
I'm interested to know why young blokes would give a damn about going away to war.
Why they what?
Why would they give a damn about going away to war all those many miles away? They wouldn't do it today, would they? Not in that moment.
I don't think it would. Well, they're in Afghanistan, aren't they? But of course, they're permanent army blokes. We were volunteers. I've got a... a son-in-law who once said to me, he said he wished to be another war because he'd want to be a returned black. Well, he was, I don't know what he was then, 30, his father was a returned black.
You were discussing why chaps would consider going away.
In my time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, and this would apply to me, and I'm sure it would be... we're all influenced by what happened in World War One. We didn't then, of course, we weren't able to appreciate where the fighting would be. But World War One, Australians went over there, did a little, and the same would apply here. It was a much bigger spread, outreaching war than the first one. I must admit, I often wonder why a bloke volunteers for the infantry. It couldn't happen, but I think anyone who volunteers for the infantry, and there's so much other branches of the army, etc., that they've got it rocks in their heads.
Why?
Well, you're a frontline troop. You've either got to get... You'll get knocked over, for sure. And it'll be you'll be killed, maimed, or get a blighty and go home. I mean, infantry, you've got no chance. I mean, that World War One, God, that's dreadful, you know, the Somme and so on. They just... And Gallipoli, just get out of trenches, head down. You know damn well you're going to get knocked. You know, and there's plenty of places behind there. We're all returned blokes, but they're relatively safe. But someone's got to do it, I suppose.
So here you are, joining up. What was involved?
The actual joining up. Well, I came down from Kellerbarron and went with 1, 2, 3, 4 other coppers. We all went in, and hand on the Bible, and got in a queue, given a number. My number was WX4759, my copper was 4760, we had a physical test. Medical test, which is pretty routine, eyes and I suppose... I can't remember much. I know my eyes weren't too good, but anyway, I got in. And then away we went back to wherever we came from. About 3 weeks or a month later, we were called up again, and I really can't remember what they did the second time. But we kept going from there. You know, we went straight up to Northern and marched from the northern camp. There's a big camp there, which is a local WAIF camp. We marched about 3 miles out to the camp and went up to, I suppose it's a recruiting thing. I remember our 2RC of our battalion was there, who we knew slightly. He was a client of Elders. He was a cocky from Arnold Potts, farmer from Cajunup. Oh, we didn't know him really, but we reckon we did because he was a client of Elders.
So you're talking about Arnold Potts. What sort of character was he?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Arnold Potts was, he enlisted in the first 16th, World War One. I think he's on Gallipoli, I'm not sure about that. But anyway, he got a field commission, ended up with the captain, got an MC, wounded, came home, and he went to the same school as I did, Guildford Grammar School. And he was a very fine, likeable bloke, and he was in militia pre-World War II, and because he's in the first 16th, he enlisted with the second 16th infantry battalion with the rank of a major, and he was OC of our headquarters company, and he was the bloke that he was there when we were all lining up to be allocated to a company and so forth in the our battalion. Now, I don't know whether you want me to go on about Potts.
Yeah.
Arnold Potts was 2IC of our battalion when we got to Palestine, second in command. And our CO, a chap by the name of Baxter Cox, was promoted to brigadier, and he went off to take over an Australian brigade. And we all hoped that Potts would be the CO, but he wasn't. He remained, they got a Victorian over. And Potsy was 2IC of our battalion right through Syria. And here's the only time we always saw Potsy, usually between us and where the busy French were. We never saw our CO, but I suppose he was back there somewhere. And the whole battalion adored Potsy. He was a wonderful bloke. He had the ability to come down to our level. And he was a real leader and greatly admired. Well, he eventually took over the battalion after Syria, Armistead. And by the time that was, when was that, the middle of 1941, Potts was made a lieutenant colonel. And by the time we came back, to come back to Australia, Potts, which was about another 6 months, Potts was promoted to brigadier and was commanding officer of our brigade, which is the 21st Infantry Brigade. And he took us into the Owen Stanleys, New Guinea. And he fought a wonderful campaign there. There's a lot of publicity about what happened there with Ian Blamey and MacArthur. They eventually, because Blamey reckoned that we ran away instead of fighting, which is absolute crap. We were only about 600 strong. We went up there, less than that. And I know there was 15 in my company when we finally got out. And Potts did a wonderful job. I understand there were about 10,000 Japs there. There's a bloody army of them there at Kokoda. And we got there with there was one militia battalion there, and ourselves and the 2nd 14th from Victoria. And there was only about 1,000 blokes there altogether against these Japs, who were totally outnumbered. And they had a mountain gun. Anyway, Potts fought a wonderful withdrawal. Perhaps we'll go into that a bit later. But he was sacked. The bloody old Blamey. Can I go on about him? Who was the... in charge of the land forces of New Guinea, and he was then a general. I think, yeah, general. He was the boss of the Australian Army. And he'd never been to bloody New Guinea, you know, and we pulled out, and we were all pretty ragged. I think there's probably less than 100 now battalions still on their feet, all killed, wounded, dengue fever, etc., etc. And he accused us of being like rabbits, just running away. And there's bloody near, I don't know if you've heard all about this, he paraded us up. And this, to my knowledge, was the first time he'd been to New Guinea. He was all yelling and screaming from Brisbane when we were in the Owen Stanleys. And he did accuse us of running away. There's no doubt about that. He said rabbits without... they hear a shot, they run away, and that's what he accused us of. And there was, within an ace of a bloody mutiny, there was. I was...
Only rabbits run that... Sorry, only rabbits that run get shot, or something like that.
It was only rabbits that run... I think you probably said it then.
Well, Blamey wasn't particularly well-liked.
Oh, he was disliked. I mean, you couldn't like the bloke. I don't know whether he wanted anything to go. Yeah? I mean, he was... when he was in the Middle East, his wife was over there in the Red Cross. I suppose they couldn't cohabitate over there. But he was a great womaniser, Blamey. And it was Doug Burgess, my copper, special copper, and I had a week's leave in Jerusalem. And we wanted to get out of, somewhere we could go and enjoy it on New Year's Eve it was. And we found a nice restaurant down by the Jerusalem Railway Station. And it wasn't that crowded. It was about 8 o'clock and we were the only blokes in there, the mainly locals, in uniform. I think we were both sergeants then. Anyway. because of the blackout, the heavy drapes and so forth, and suddenly the drapes parted. We were standing up the bar. In came old Blamey in mufti, not in uniform, with a bloody chromo. Do you know what a chromo is? Well, a harlot, if you like, you know. You could tell just by looking at it. Anyway, there he was with this female. He had one look at us, turn, went out again because he saw the Australian uniform. And that was his pattern over there. And I probably shouldn't be talking on about him, but he was totally disliked. He wasn't respecting him.